Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
This show gets all kinds of emails, comments about the shows, calls for advice, some of which I share. A recurring request is that I read classic stories or do audiobooks. I would do audiobooks, but nobody has asked me. I've read a ton of stories out loud, all to my kids when they were tots. Bedtime stories with them were some of the best moments of my life. On the rare nights that I was away, I felt gypped. Both were born and raised in Los Angeles, where, despite all the golf courses and lawns, L.A. is built in the desert, and no matter how scorching the day may be, the nights are usually cool. Temperatures can swing from 110 at noon to 55 at midnight. Which means the windows were open, and a chorus of crickets accompanied every story. Often there were owls hooting in the eucalyptus trees. Sometimes coyotes joined the refrain. That's one of the nice things about the San Fernando Valley. You can live in a metropolis, yet be very close to nature. One night, my younger daughter asked me why there were crickets. I told her, God made them so solitary people would have something nice to listen to as they drifted off to sleep and wouldn't feel so alone. When I read to them, it was classics from Mother Goose to Beatrix Potter, Goodnight Moon, Hans Christian Andersen, even the Brothers Grimm. I preferred to read them material that delivered some wisdom along with the story. Aesop's Fables did that really well. Their all-time favorites was probably Squirrel Nutkin, and that's likely my fault. I found no other character in Kitty Litt that compared with Nutkin. He was an outlier, a free spirit, and most of all, Nutkin loved to fuck with authority. His fellow squirrels worked like drones, harvesting nuts from Old Brown's Island, Old Brown being this enormous owl. The squirrels had to pay tribute to Brown, so he'd allow them to collect nuts on his private domain. Each day they'd bring him luscious treats, moles and mice or eggs and fish. This kept his belly full, so he wouldn't decide to eat a squirrel. While the group scurried around filling sacks with nuts, Nutkin would tease and torment the owl. He'd throw crazy riddles at him and bowl on his doorstep with acorns, shit like that. No matter what Nutkin did, the owl never flinched. Just stood there like he was made of stone. After 6 days of this, they lay in enough nuts for the winter, and they gather on Brown's doorstep to thank him and say goodbye until the next autumn. And that's when Nutkin torques up his harassment to DEFCON 1. He shoves a thorny branch right in Old Brown's face. And Brown proves he's not as old as he looks when he snatches Nutkin in one sharp talon, drags him inside to make a meal of him. He's got him pinned down by the tail, and Nutkin realizes it's curtains, and that's when he makes one mighty move for freedom and tears his own tail off, then escapes through a window. It's really a marvelous story on so many levels. First, it's funny as hell, but only to those who enjoy flouting authority, which, in our current bootlicking culture of reverence and respect for authority, well, that's no longer deemed funny. Second, it challenges the mind. Each crazy sing-song rhyme that Nutkin recites has a riddle built into it. Not just a riddle, but a riddle written in 19th century British parlance. So they're not all that easy to solve. But the most important element of the story is one that appealed to me on a visceral level. It's the eternal struggle of the individual versus the hive and the overlords. For a century and a half, American individuals were winning that struggle. The tide turned with the beginning of income tax in 1913. Next, it was banning alcohol 7 years later, and it's been downhill ever since to where we are now. That little punks in Washington are telling us what we can or cannot say, demanding we take unproven drugs with hellacious side effects for an illness with a 99% survival rate. But this eternal conflict is not intrinsic to the United States. It happens all over the world. Anywhere that the few exert power over the many, and the many are powerless, like corporations and schools. The Catholic grammar and high schools I attended were very repressive environments. They were all about conformity and discipline. So consumed with the hive was my high school, their logo was a fucking beehive. I recall staring at it and feeling revulsion. They wanted us to be insects in a hive. Everything about it enraged me. The school cafeteria had no seats. You had to eat standing up at tall tables, and you had 15 minutes to do it. Then drag your ass outside and wait while the next herd of cattle came in to feed at the trough. That waiting outside for 20 minutes in February with sub-zero temps and sleet, well, that was no picnic, but that's the kind of place it was. Luckily, by mid-freshman year, I found two Confederates and freedom, and we had the most amazing adventures fucking with the authoritarian administration. Not the teachers so much. Most of them were just there to teach. A few of them were actually good guys. But the admins, oh, they were invariably ASTCOs, assholes seeking to control others. They loved making policies, banning various activities and people. If not for my two pals, I might have snapped. But because of them, we found a purpose to get through high school like guerrilla fighters behind enemy lines. And we took immense pride and joy in that work. All we wanted to do was wreak havoc and make them chase their tails and gnash their teeth as we developed hernias from the suppressed laughter. And that is, at least for me, the sweetest, most intense laughter. Nothing compares. The school actually had a guy whose title was Dean of Discipline. Of course, fucking with him was job number one. Their mode of control was a primitive version of today's. Every student was issued a photo ID card. That ID card was the key to everything. It was like an all-access pass. Without one, you could not get into school, into ball games, events, and dances. Oh, did I mention the school was boys only? Yes, it was. And in a passing nod to normality, they'd hold a few dances each year and invite girls in from similar schools that were also restricted to one sex. We don't say gender here. Gender is a commie word. When those girls strutted onto the gymnasium floor as the band played Back in Black, many of them displayed pole dancer potential. They had shucked their demure plaid skirts and saddle straps for spike-heeled boots and miniskirts. The guys, well, we were all pencil-neck geeks, but a lot of those girls were nearly women. You found out which ones during the slow dances. One long-haired brunette sent me home with a hickey that needed radiation treatment. Of course, having to spend several years separated from such divine creatures, except for those dances, well, that made us hate the school even more. It was such a fucked-up, artificial, stifling, unnatural environment. The tacit sales pitch from the school was, "Send your scholarly sons here, and they won't be distracted by females." How stupid, how futile, how creepy was that entire premise, huh? So we took endless pleasure in covertly taunting the uptight authoritarians. That same premise has been the underpinnings of some pretty fabulous works of art, like the book cum movie, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That thing damn near swept the Oscars, won Best Picture, Actor, Actress, Supporting Actor, Screenplay, and Score. It made Jack Nicholson, well, more than a star, it made him the star. After that movie, there was only one Jack in Hollywood, and every guy who was not a hive minder, wanted to be the character in that movie. When it comes down to it, the story isn't all that different from Squirrel Nutkin. Free-spirited individual antagonizes authority. Except R.P. McMurphy winds up missing not a tail, but a chunk of his brain when the head nurse, Astco, where he's incarcerated, orders his lobotomy. Would that movie be made today? No. Besides its non-PC but spot-on depictions of everybody, the foundation of the story, fuck authoritarians, well, that's become taboo. Were it remade today, McMurphy would apologize for his disrespectful behavior and request a lobotomy so he could guarantee he would never again offend. Come to think of it, he'd probably request a twofer, a lobotomy and an orchiectomy. The nurse ratchets are now operating the levers of power all over the world, in academia, corporations, and government. Their mission is not just to control, but to emasculate. And what's hysterical is how many, allegedly, male senators and congress punks are eager to drop trowel, hop onto the gyno table, put their ankles in the stirrups, and hand them a shiny new Berdizzo. Paradoxically, the only politicians with the balls to oppose the commies are female ones. Look at the outrage at school board meetings. It's almost always the moms who push back against the leftist educators. The dads act as if they've already danced with the Berdizzo. I've done a few episodes that have explored the rise of the commie gynocracy, like episode 42, Gynarchy, Larry Strikes Back. You'll find that in the September 2017 tab at thatlarryshow.com. That was only a few years back, but now the commie gynocracy is no longer on the rise. They have attained hegemony. It makes sense because at its roots, communism is matriarchal. Big government is a big mommy on which children must depend for their very survival. When a boy is bullied at school, what's most moms' first reaction, huh? Complain to the school and make them deal with the bully. Some fathers may also take that approach, probably surrogate fathers. Because a real father gets his son some self-defense training, equips him with the skills needed to beat the piss out of that bully. If he does, the boy will have courage and a sense of achievement that will sustain him for a lifetime. If he doesn't, he will live as a coward and a wimp. Hey, I'm drifting off topic here. Back to tweaking the nose of authority. I had so much fun doing that. I devoted a trilogy of episodes to it, all contained within bonus episode 3 at patreon.com/thatlarryshow. It's called Vengeance is Ours. And you know what? Right now might be a good place to reveal another such adventure. The Dean of Discipline, I mentioned earlier, he used a rudimentary method of control, which is now deployed and perfected by governments around the world, choking off freedom through denial of service. Those high school ID cards were not all that different from the banks and credit card companies and social media platforms shutting people off simply because they don't like your opinions. So if this Dean of Discipline apprehended someone misbehaving, he would immediately confiscate the ID card. Then, at 2:30 each afternoon, when everyone was in their places with bored and angry faces, Doc, that was the nickname we gave him, Doc would make the announcements over the PA system. Clearly, the guy had broadcast aspirations, although he had zero ability. He had a thick Bronx accent and the delivery of a zombie. His announcements would go something like this.
Intramural baseball practice has been canceled this afternoon due to precipitation.
He could have called it rain or weather, but don't assholes always choose the five-syllable words? Yes, they do. Next, he'd drone on about all the usual drivel, where the chess club would meet today, and what school the mathletes would be challenging at the next competition. And then he'd end with his favorite part.
All students whose ID cards were confiscated today.
Got that? Confiscated, not taken.
All students whose ID cards were confiscated today must report to me in room 123 immediately following these announcements. Those students include Rocco Garacio, James Battaglia, John Genova, Francis Kowalski, Paul Costello, and Martin McBride. That is all.
Yes, the student body was heavily Italian. Doc probably thought he was publicly shaming them, but for those guys, it was an achievement. The next day, everyone would want to know what they'd been pinched for. Chewing gum in class or boosting a Buick. Neither I nor my two pals, Jimmy and Frank, ever had our ID cards clipped by Doc. We were just too skilled at covert ops. A quick detour here, but I really want you to know how these events came to pass. There was an old movie that used to play on TV back then. It was about the French Revolution. And the money scene was the attempted assassination of Robespierre. He was in a crowded auditorium, delivering a rousing speech in his tricorner hat and ruffled collar. At the back of the room, one assassin whispered to the other,
"Silence his mouth."
Well, the assassin pulled a flintlock pistol, braced it on his forearm, and put a lead ball directly into Robespierre's open gub, which did silence him, save for choking on the projectile and his own blood. We thought it was the funniest thing we'd ever seen, such marksmanship with a crude pistol, and the immediate fulfillment of a whispered command. Being a movie, it meant the truth. In fact, the shot missed his mouth and took off his lower jaw instead. They tied his jaw to his head with a rag, and he lived through the night in agony until they could properly finish him with a guillotine in the morning. I love the French. So one day, as Doc is making his announcements, my buddy Jimmy looks at me and, mimicking the movie, says,
"Silence his mouth."
I thought that was funny as hell. But I had no pistol. Doc was two floors below us, muttering into a D-104 microphone, and he'd never pissed me off enough to even consider homicide. But Jimmy's comment did trigger an idea. Every classroom had the same vintage loudspeaker hanging over the door. They were designed no different than any speaker, a convex paper cone hidden behind a fabric cover. Once that paper cone is torn or punctured, the speaker is finished. I flashed on a plan whereby we could silence Doc's mouth by proxy. That would put a bug deep in his ass. That would enrage the entire faculty in delight. 95% of the students. Jimmy was a gifted thief and pickpocket. He had stolen sets of teachers' keys, which gave us access to any door we wanted, including the labs. They were the usual affairs, where chemical experiments with Bunsen burners and dissections of frogs and fetal pigs took place. My favorite tools were the lances used to pin body parts to the operating table. They functioned as perfect dart-like projectiles, and for our purpose, they were better than darts, because the business end was a 3 or 4 inch needle. It was long enough to penetrate the cloth covers of those speakers and puncture the paper cone. We soon hatched a plan. One afternoon, we loitered until dusk, and it was fairly certain all classrooms would be deserted. Every footfall of ours echoed on the shiny linoleum lining those darkening hallways. There's always a certain thrill you get doing shit like that. Your energy level is over the moon. You're wound like a spring. I suspect professional jewel thieves get a similar rush during their heists. We worked floor by floor, starting at the top. Frank positioned himself in the hallway as the primary lookout. Jimmy covered one of the stairwells. That gave us about 66% coverage of threats. It left one stairwell unguarded and the elevator. But the elevator operated by key only for faculty, and Jimmy had the key, so he shut it off. If a faculty member approached, the plan was to give a hearty and loud hello to the teacher and engage him in conversation. Babble some bullshit about having to return a book forgotten in a locker. Big test tomorrow. That dialogue would alert the actual thief to hide or make tracks. Since it was my idea, I was that thief, went into the lab, quickly found the lances, stole the whole fucking box. There were dozens. Next, it was time to distribute them and silence Doc's proxy mouths, every loudspeaker in every classroom. Fortunately, most doors were left unlocked, and we had the master key. I divided the lances between myself and Frank. Jimmy would pop the door. Frank or I would fire a lance at the speaker and puncture it. The lance's wooden handles blended perfectly with the speakers, so we just let them hang there. You really had to stare at them to notice the lance. No one would until the following day at 2:30 p.m. when they would hear the fruits of our labor. We managed to impale every speaker in the building. How many? I don't know, but there were three floors of classrooms. That night, I could hardly sleep. The next day, the minutes passed like weeks. I couldn't wait until 2:30. Finally, the buzzer rang, and all eyes turned to that speaker as we waited for Doc's oration. But instead of his words, we heard something like this. Then they noticed the lance sticking out of the speaker like a tiny harpoon, and the laughter began, which pissed off the teacher, actually dozens of teachers, as the exact same scene played out simultaneously in dozens of classes with hundreds and hundreds of kids. Were there consequences? Fuck no, because Frank, Jimmy, and I were great at covert ops, and even better at the most important part of any caper, keeping our mouths shut. As much as we wanted to brag and tell everyone we did it, we never did. And so, we were never caught. Score? Free-spirited, indomitable kids? 1. Authority? 0. Was there a shitstorm? Hell yeah. Every one of those speakers had to be replaced. Paper copies of Doc's daily announcements had to be made and distributed to every teacher for a couple of weeks while repairs are made. They were even offering a reward for information, leading to the apprehension and expulsion of the vandals. That gave me a sense of pride. There was an outlaw biker gang called the Vandals. I wondered if they'd give me an honorary membership. I didn't think of us as vandals, though. It was not the wanton, mindless destruction of property. That was for morons. What we did was actually sabotage. It had multiple purposes. First was to amuse us. Second was to enrage them. Third was to send a message to show them that they were not all-powerful, that they were vulnerable, that they could be fucked with. Capers are like a drug. We always needed a bigger hit, so once the entire school had been equipped with shiny new PA speakers, ones that were vandal-resistant, well, of course, we had to show them once again that they were still vulnerable, and I hatched another plan. This plan went right after Doc. It was more audacious than harpooning speakers. This caper was at the Mission Impossible level. Join me next week, and I'll tell you about it. Thanks for hanging with me once again. It's always great to be with you. Stop by the show page for more content and commentary. While there, click a subscribe button so you never miss an episode. If you like what you heard, click the Patreon or PayPal button and help me keep this adventure going. Follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Mastodon social networks. All those links are also at thatlarryshow.com. Write to me at thatlarryshow@gmail.com. And if you'd like a piece of show merch, we've got a limited supply of very cool vintage motel key fobs. They look great, feel right, and won't get lost in your bag. And best of all, they tell the world you're a member of the Take No Shit Dojo. My friends, remember this. You are not powerless. There isn't a lock that can't be picked or cut, a code that can't be cracked, or a power structure that can't be toppled. I'll see you next Wednesday for that next caper. And until that time, stay strong, cool, and take no shit.